body test, as we've been discussing, there's no way to say that they're likely to develop AIDS. So we'd have to assume that at least 80% of those individuals are going to get turned down when they apply for insurance coverage, that they're never going to have the medical problem that the insurance industry is worried about. And of course, there's the issue also of, given that, if that is correct, that 80% figure, that those individuals should be insured, we just don't know who is in the 80% group. There's a question about the fairness then of denying them the coverage and eliminating coverage for individuals who actually might develop AIDS, who otherwise could pay into the system as an insurance subscriber and for years before there are any signs, any symptoms of the illness actually develop. But they may have had the antibody and the virus for years and years before that ever develops.
Is it legal for an insurance company to ask for a blood test, and are there insurance companies already doing that?
Well, this varies state by state. In Wisconsin, there was a statewide law adopted which very severely restricted the insurance company's ability to do that sort of testing. And the insurance industry has a very effective lobby, and they managed to get that provision reversed so that they are able to test. And this varies from state to state. Generally, state laws on insurance bar discrimination, say, on the basis of sex or marital status. So they couldn't discriminate against all single men in metropolitan areas, for example. But they probably can, under current law, give that kind of test. And that's going to be one of the big disputes and issues that undoubtedly will be debated in the legislatures about whether or not insurance companies are allowed to do that kind of testing.
Insurance companies play the odds. They hope they insure you and nothing's going to happen. Are they trying to screen out people who they consider to be high-risk situations? And are there leading questions showing up on forms now designed to screen out the high-risk population people?
Well, there have been some instances I know of on a national basis where the AIDS antibody test has been administered before they would consider insuring an individual. Now, that has come up, and there are complaints about that sort of thing going on. But in general, at this point, they're not changing the application forms, although maybe they're in the works now. It's certainly something they're concerned about, so there aren't really significant changes in insurance companies' approaches. And they've said recently, some of the underwriters, that they're not changing their approach on this. But that may happen. In fact, I advise gay clients of mine, if they're looking at their insurance coverage, they may want to consider applying for insurance now, obtaining coverage before the standards change and it becomes extremely difficult to get the insurance without going through a very intrusive process of being tested or examined regarding these particular health issues.
My guest is David Weber, and he's the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. He's also legal counsel for the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force. There have been a lot of controversies about how people with AIDS should be treated at work and also how people who test positive should be treated at work. There have been instances where people with AIDS have been fired, and people who test positive, I think, have also faced discrimination in the workplace. Employers see it as their responsibility to protect the rest of their employees by someone who might be contagious. Is that a legitimate reason from the legal point of view for firing somebody who has AIDS or who tests positive?
Absolutely not. I think here's a situation where I would be in agreement with most management lawyers who look at this problem, or with personnel officials, say, in large employers. And everyone is in agreement that AIDS itself, or probably even the AIDS antibody, would be viewed as a handicapping condition or a disability that would be covered by either federal, state, or local non-discrimination laws. So an individual who even has AIDS, as long as they're well enough to work, and that's sort of the highest threshold example of someone's experience with this illness, that individual, if they're fired or even transferred to another position where maybe they won't have contact with coworkers or with the public, that would be unlawful employment discrimination. And already there's been a ruling in Florida by the Human Relations Commission there on a statewide basis that discrimination on the basis of AIDS is unlawful handicap discrimination. We'll see more of those cases, and I think we can predict very reasonably how they're all going to come out. They'll come out in the employee's favor. Now, you asked about the co-workers' concerns, and co-workers do have some rights to a safe workplace. And what all you have to remember, though, is that having the person, even with AIDS, or who's tested positive on the antibody test, which is a less serious situation, those individuals don't pose any risk to the co-workers. And there have been complaints even of nurses, say, who don't want to care for someone who has AIDS in a hospital setting, making a complaint that it's an unsafe working condition. And those complaints have not gone anywhere. There are precautions that can be taken in the situations where there might be exposure to body fluids that might transmit the virus. And those precautions can be taken. But there's no reason to reassign the employee or fire the person who has AIDS as a way of dealing with that problem. What we really need to do is get the what employers should do if they have this problem is get the sound scientific and medical information to their employees so that they understand that there's no risk to them of working with someone with AIDS.
Practically, we all know that if you're going to be fired for a reason that is legally controversial, you can just be fired for a different reason instead. If you have AIDS, you don't have to be fired because your employer tells you you have AIDS. You can be a little slow on the job lately or tardy at work in the morning. There are all kinds of excuses that you can use. So what would the legal recourse be practically for someone who was fired and they suspect it's because they tested positive or because they have AIDS?
Well, this is... So actually, you're absolutely right that employers oftentimes try to disguise what they're doing so that the illegality of their actions is not very clear to that employee. But with AIDS cases, it's not unusual for that to be the issue. That comes up. That's what triggers the firing. And it's really a really grossly unjust situation. Here's someone, if it's someone who has AIDS, they've probably recently been diagnosed as having AIDS so that they know they have this life-threatening illness. They're ready to sometimes go back to work or continue working. And the employer just tells them they no longer have their job. So it's almost like finding out you have a life-threatening illness and then losing one's job. The traumatizing effect of that one thing after another is really an awful experience. I've seen that with my clients of how hard it is on the individual. And I think it's even a threat to their health when an employer acts that way. It is completely below the standards that we should expect of employers in this society. And I think that employers who do that, if they're stupid enough to fire someone or treat them as unfairly as that, they're going to find themselves in costly legal battles. Even if the individual has AIDS, they may die later, and the cases are probably going to continue anyway. And I think you'll find if the public is well educated to this problem, and it's not the too distant future when some of these cases may go to trial, that juries will be awarding significant punitive damages against employers that act this way against individuals with AIDS.
Briefly, there have been a few cases around the country where people have been charged basically for using their disease as a deadly weapon biting somebody or for spitting at someone, and this was before more was known about the saliva, because now doctors seem to agree that saliva doesn't transmit
AIDS. That's right.
AIDS. But before that was known, someone was found, I think, guilty of felonious assault for spitting at an officer. Is this a big issue in the legal community now?
No, I don't think so. I think there are a few cases nationally where it's come up, and for some reason those cases have captured a lot of attention in the media. I don't think they deserve very much attention. They're very unusual. What I see with people who have AIDS or people in the gay community, which just as a community that is dealing as kind of high-risk community, that people tend to act very responsibly. It's just the opposite kind of behavior. I mean, people are not knowingly engaging in sexual relations with people, knowing that they might transmit the virus. It's just the opposite, that there's a much changed consciousness about the risks, and certainly intentional acts like that are very unusual.
You, in addition to monitoring legislation on AIDS, you're also monitoring gay rights legislation. How do you think the AIDS epidemic has affected the ongoing fight for gay rights legislation?
Well, what it's done, I think, is has distracted or sidelined the efforts to develop affirmative legal protection on the basis of sexual orientation. In other words, people are spending a lot of time now just working on these on AIDS legislation, and usually just trying to get some completely ridiculous proposal from keeping it from going through and being passed into law. That's where the efforts are going now, instead of developing affirmative protection for people, say, on the basis of sexual orientation or other protections for lesbian women and gay men.
There are still sodomy laws on the books in some states. Because AIDS can be spread through anal intercourse, are those sodomy laws starting to be enforced in ways that they weren't before?
Well, where that is really an issue, an enforcement of those laws has always been fairly arbitrary and unfair, but that's just the nature of the government's attempt to criminalize activities like that. Those laws tend to get they tend to be enforced in a very unfair way. Now it's only a minority of states that have those laws. Pennsylvania does not, for example, hasn't since 1980. But where this is an issue, and will be very significant, I'd expect sometime in the very near future, is when the Supreme Court will be deciding a case or perhaps two cases involving these statutes. And without going into all the technical legal arguments, and there are numerous arguments involved in these cases, the court may never really get to the merits of whether a state can criminalize those sexual activities, and it could be oral sex or anal sex usually involved. All I can say is that what's changed now regarding the sodomy statutes is the state's justification for those laws. It used to be just that the state, in arguing that they could criminalize those activities, was that the state was just enforcing morality, and that was really all that was the basis for the laws. More recently, either explicitly in arguments made in court, or I think it's just implication of the state's interest in promoting the health and welfare of the citizens. There's a kind of argument that by criminalizing these sexual activities, we're adopting a public health measure. And that, of course, is just a totally wrong approach to this. What you end up doing is stigmatizing people, kind of, especially with gay men, kind of putting them back in the closet by criminalizing their sexual activities. And that's just what we don't want to do at this point. We want to make individuals who may be in high-risk groups feel free to seek information that they can use to protect their health.
We heard earlier from a state representative who proposed a bill that, if passed, would require mandatory blood tests for the HTLV-3 virus for people seeking a marriage license and would prevent them from getting married if they tested positive. There are other current bills like that being proposed in the Pennsylvania legislature, do you know?
There are other things involving screening. There's one proposal that would allow county commissioners to impose mandatory screening for inmates in prisons or people in nursing homes. And I have difficulty figuring out what the point of any of those laws is. The marriage license proposal, for example, it seems to assume that everyone who gets married is going to have children. And the intent, in part, I suppose, is so that the two prospective spouses will know about each other, whether either of them have been exposed to the AIDS virus. It seems to me, though, that the state doesn't need to get involved in helping people make that determination, that it's something they should be able to determine themselves about whether they're going to enter into that relationship.
What kind of precedents do you think we're going to set now for the future in the way that we handle legislation concerning the spread of AIDS?
Well, it's very hard to say. I think we'll continue to see what are fairly crazy ideas in state legislatures. Issues come up or legislation is proposed which is supposed to address public health issues, but what really underlies that legislation is bias or prejudice against gay men and lesbian women, and that's really what is going on with a lot of these legislative attempts. So it may be just because of the unpopularity of the groups that are involved, the minority groups, that they may go through with a lot of this legislation. It may be up to the courts to rule on its constitutionality. I do not think most of these proposals would survive scrutiny in the courts.
Okay, thank you very much for talking with us. And I've been speaking with David Weber, who's the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And this is the second in our two-day series of special programs about AIDS. Many legal and medical experts agree that in the absence of a cure or a preventive vaccine for AIDS, the best tool we have to contain the spread of the epidemic is education. Scientists know much more about the virus than they did last year at this time, and far more than they did when the virus was first identified in America in 1981. Medical experts want to reassure the American public that AIDS can't be spread through casual contact. They say you can only get AIDS if infected blood or sperm comes in direct contact with your bloodstream, as it can if you share IV needles or engage in anal or vaginal intercourse without a condom. Most of us rely on the mass media for our information about AIDS. Our understanding of AIDS and how it is spread is based on what we've seen, heard, and read through the mass media, from cover stories in Time and Newsweek to network TV specials to TV docudramas. Even dramatic series are sending us messages about AIDS. Just last week, one of the main characters on St. Elsewhere, Dr. Mark Harmon, left the hospital and the series after he was diagnosed as having the fatal illness. With me to evaluate the media coverage of AIDS and how it shaped the American reaction to the epidemic is Larry Gross, professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications of the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-authored many studies of television violence and TV portrayals of women and minorities and the impact of these portrayals on viewers. Gross co-chairs the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and is a member of the AIDS Task Force. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Do you think that the media coverage of AIDS has set the stage for the American response?
Oh, yeah. I think the media coverage has informed and often misinformed almost everyone in America and around the world about AIDS because AIDS, by its nature, is something that very few people have now or will ever come into direct contact with.
The press has been called everything from sensitive to sensational, and they've been accused of not covering it enough and then accused on dwelling on it obsessively. Do you think there's any truth in any of those accusations?
Well, yes, there's truth in all of them. It's really a matter of the sequence and the pattern. When the AIDS epidemic or the AIDS problem began to become clear, it was ignored by the media. And it was ignored, I think, for the fairly obvious reason that it dealt with a group that's ignored by the media and a problem seen as being associated with IV drug users at that time, although no longer with Haitians, and primarily with gay men, was certainly nothing that was of great interest to the population or the general public, and also was seen as sort of contaminated with questionable taste. So that it was not really paid attention to. And the problem, I think, that has existed both for the gay community and for the public health community as, I think, a major player in the whole situation has been in knowing how to deal with the sudden switch from famine to feast, from being ignored to being drowned in attention. Because the ways one learns to or the way one thinks about situations when no one's paying attention have to be rethought very quickly when suddenly everyone's paying attention. Let me just give you a specific example. During the period when the media began moving AIDS from a back page to a front page story so that AIDS became by definition newsworthy, there was a tendency, and I think there still is, to run non-stories. That the media would use it as a teaser for the evening news, or put it on the cover of magazines or papers, when in fact there was no news, and when it was basically recycling something that had been published, in the New England Journal of Medicine, or not even that, and some doctors became sort of drawn into it, so that in one or two cases, press conferences were used as the form for breaking medical news, something that, for good reason, the medical profession frowns upon, because you know, it needs to be evaluated a little more carefully before it becomes public. So all sides of this triangle of the gay community, the medical community, and the media, I think, need to learn how to deal with something of this sort.
Are there examples of specific broadcasts or print stories that you thought exemplified excellent media coverage of AIDS and exemplified poor coverage?
Well, all right, let me get the excellent out of the way faster and then make a general comment about the poor or the more coverage. I think one of the better examples of media coverage, other than present company, has been the most of the work done by the Philadelphia Inquirer, in particular Donald Drake's extensive coverage. Other work, they have a reporter currently doing stories on the sort of more social aspects of it, who is doing very good work. And in general, I think the Daily News in Philadelphia has also been very good. And they made a few slips, the Inquirer and the Daily News, I think, in the beginning, but nothing that would be seriously problematic. And I think also, to be fair, that the television and radio in Philadelphia have been reasonably good, although I've had problems with some of the things that they've done. But the larger issue of the problematic aspects or the unfortunate aspects, I think, have to do with fitting into two larger agendas or two larger sets of stereotypes. One is how the media deal with gays to begin with, and secondly, how they deal with issues having to do with sex. And then I'll start with the second one first. It seems to me that AIDS came along, you know, quite accidentally, because it was certainly unforeseen, at a point in American history when it fit into one of the dominant public agenda items, namely the counter-revolution against what is called the sexual revolution. The late 70s resurgence of social conservatism, or at least an attempt to impose social conservatism. And before AIDS, it was herpes. Herpes was all over the media. Time magazine announced that the party was over. It was time to cool it, and the image that was broadcast over and over again, whether it's in movies like Looking for Mr. Goodbar or in cover stories in Time and Newsweek about herpes, was that something vaguely called promiscuity can be fatal, that sex can kill you, that, you know, you thought it was okay now that we had the pill and now that we had legalized abortion and now that we had divorce and now that we had women being more independent. But, you know, think again. Sex will get you killed, either by some crazed person you pick up in a bar or by some horrible disease, as herpes was being misrepresented, really, as being. So AIDS had a slot already to fit into when it came along. And that then fit very neatly with the dominant way in which the media deal with gay people when they deal with gay people, because most of the time they deal with gay people by not dealing with them, by ignoring them, by denying their presence or their existence for a variety of reasons. But when gay people have been visible in the media, rather similar to blacks for much of the 20th century in the mass media, they have been present either as victims or as villains. The villainous role is fairly common, for example, images of lesbians in movies or in television or in fiction general, is a kind of sinister woman who's probably interested sexually in the beautiful young thing whom she's leering at or something, that kind of image. And gay men begin as victims of humor and end up as being villainous in other ways. So that for a long time, the image of gay men, and still today, if you listen to Eddie Murphy or someone like that, is the butt of a joke, that gay men are safe, and particularly in a period in which you can increasingly, or in which it's harder and harder to find a group you can make fun of. Gays have played the role of being someone you could make fun of. So the victim-villain roles are, again, perfectly suited for something like AIDS, because here they can be the victim of this horrible new disease, so that gay becomes nearly synonymous with AIDS victim in the public mind, and at the same time they're a threat. At the same time, it's this force that is going to unleash a disease on the rest of the world.
Well, you've accused the press of playing up the the whole party's over idea that, well, you had your sexual revolution and, boy, it's backfiring now, so you'd better cut it out. But isn't that the way a lot of individuals are reacting to in kind of second-guessing the
Well, but
number
the individuals,
of partners that
they have? The individuals, as I really meant when I said at the very beginning that most people, including most gay people, have not come into very much direct contact with AIDS, at least not anywhere near the extent to which they've come into contact with it through the media. And when I say the media, I'm not really exempting the gay media completely, because to the extent that they are part of the same culture, I think they've very often played many of the same tunes in terms of their treatment. And when, I read two sentences from the Newsweek stories of the Newsweek cover story of the week that Rock Hudson died last August, it says, speaking of AIDS, and this is a bold type, so you don't even have to read much to see it when you open it, it will end the sexual revolution. You can take your chances with herpes or hepatitis B, but you can't take your chances with this. So that this is the final end. And in the same article, it says, the message goes out for everybody that the healthy sexual style is the single partner. Now, that's really the message here, is that monogamy, preferably for straight people in married relationships, that's the only safe. Up until now, we've been told it's the only moral sexual style, and we know that morality doesn't sell that well, but health is very much the thing of the 80s, and now we're being told it's the only healthy style.
The experts who've appeared on this show from epidemiology and from the medical profession all agree that the best way that we have now of containing the AIDS epidemic is through education about safe sex practices. And that's something that the media has been participating in to some extent. But there are some interesting dilemmas for the media when dealing with this particular kind of education. One is that to talk about safe sex, you have to talk about sex very explicitly. And it's something that, with the exception of programs like Dr. Ruth, the media tends to avoid. And that some readers actually, and listeners and viewers, find very objectionable. And the other thing is, you'd be talking about gay as well as heterosexual sexual practices, and that would be considered objectionable to hear by many people. So how do you think the media, the different forms of media, have done in trying to disseminate information about safe sex practices?
Well, I don't think they've done very well at all. I think in large part for the reasons that you've just mentioned. When you won't talk about something, it's hard to do things that require fairly explicit information. And I think that's one of the reasons, although, as I said, I think there are other reasons as well that feed into it. It's one of the reasons why the focus has been overwhelmingly on a concept vaguely described by the term promiscuity that gets used over and over again, because that is a relatively easy thing to say in media acceptable language, namely multiple partners or promiscuity and the sort of anonymous sex, other terms they could use, somehow being unsafe. Whereas in sort of technical fact, that's not really the issue. The issue isn't how many people you do something with, it's what you do. And as your listeners will have heard yesterday from Bob Sharar and others, AIDS is a very easy disease to avoid. By now, it's quite well known how it's transmitted and the implications for how to avoid it, even while having sexual relations, is available. The problem is that it's not going to be very effective if people aren't allowed to use the words or say them. And possibly Phil Donahue is the only context in which things will actually get said, or you said Dr. Ruth, but not enough people will hear it. I'll give you a very good example of a specific location where this is a problem that doesn't even require dealing with the media. Take prisons. Prisons are institutions in which there is an enormous amount of drug use and in which there's an enormous amount of sexual activity. But the officials, who very well know that there's an enormous amount of drug use and an enormous amount of sexual activity, are also completely unwilling to admit it in any way, and as a result are not very cooperative in efforts to educate the prison population, prisoners as well as guards, about these kinds of facts, because they feel that to do that would be to admit what everyone already knows, but which they proceed to deny. The same kind of problem, in a less obvious, less extreme fashion, happens in the schools, public education, and it happens in the mass media in general. The kind of ostrich-like position that somehow assumes if you don't talk about it, it isn't there.
What kind of work do you think the media could be doing or should be doing from your perspective to disseminate information about how AIDS is and isn't transmitted and also about safe sex practices?
Well, I think realistically, the easiest thing to do within the present system as it operates with the media is for them to make a major effort to alert the public as, you know, about where they can get information through things like hotline numbers and means like that, is to make it as easy as possible for people who want information to locate it, even if they don't have to say it, you know, say those dreadful words on the air. But that in itself is not yet quite enough, because you have to recognize that some of the groups that are of greatest concern are people who are deep in the closet. And getting that information over the air doesn't mean that they're quite going to have the nerve to make a phone call. They might make a phone call, but to get a publication, to hold something that somebody might want to know why they have it, you know, that someone might find in their wallet or find in their pocket, is dangerous. The mass media have an enormous advantage, which is they reach into your living room in the context of regular programming, and you don't have to account to anybody for why you happen to be watching it.
AIDS has recently entered the arena of evening television drama. And just last week, watchers of St. Elsewhere saw Dr. Mark Harmon leave the hospital where he worked because he had gotten AIDS. And he got it not through any of the major ways that you're most likely to get it. He got it through intercourse with a woman, and medical experts seem to agree that that's one of the definitely less likely ways of getting it. And
so they got it from a scriptwriter.
But it's interesting that in some of these TV shows, they've given people very exceptional ways of getting AIDS. And I have a quote here from the producer of St. Elsewhere. He was quoted in an AP story as saying, "By making it heterosexual, we make it more common and less easily dismissible." And I wonder how you'd react to that, because, I mean, he was making a defense for doing it this way as a politically correct and a socially, you know, morally correct way of doing it, so that more people would empathize with it and feel that it was their concern.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that with his assessment, and I think it's unfortunate in a variety of ways. The first conclusion I would reach, as I said earlier, is I think this fits in with the larger media and cultural agenda of rolling back the sexual revolution. It's as if they're saying or thinking, well, as long as we keep talking about AIDS as a gay or IV drug user problem, most people aren't going to see that as their problem, so they won't get the point. The point being sex is dangerous or, you know, promiscuous sex is dangerous. So the sort of underlying lesson of, you know, you're at risk when you screw around, I think may in fact be dishonest or at least disingenuous. It's not really the problem. I think the question also of assuming that this is how you're going to get people to care, or this is why people should care because it can happen to them, has been one of the problems that has run through the media treatment. The Inquirer, which I complimented earlier, in the very early days, going back now to 1981, when AIDS was just emerging, the first time that AIDS moved from the back pages to the front page of the Inquirer was a headline that said, "Heterosexuals can get it too." I don't remember the exact words, but the import was AIDS is spreading to the straight community. Now it's a real story. You know, now it's important. And that has tended to run through, just as there's been a tendency to use a term, and this is now again another quote from the Newsweek story, showing a picture of a mother and children, straight woman and children, as saying and referring to them as blameless victims. The implication that there are people out there who are blameless because they didn't do sex, and sex, of course, is what makes you guilty.
Another way, though, of looking at the issue of portraying the disease as being just within certain communities is that the more you see it as a disease that other people are susceptible to, the more involved they'll feel with issues like research funds that are available, civil liberties questions that are raised, because the more you can distance yourself and say, I am not part of this high-risk population, the less that you can care, the less you want your tax dollars to go to support it and so on. So, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question. I'm a little reluctant, though, to engage in or encourage what I consider fundamentally dishonest or at least disingenuous tactics in order to achieve ends which I'm interested in. I think those can backfire. I think the truth is a good enough argument in this case, and I don't want to encourage sort of misleading ways of approach. I think that part of the problem that the American public have to face is that a serious disease that affects a fairly large part of the population requires attention, requires help. And I think that it needn't be sort of overhyped as coming to your neighborhood soon in order to accomplish that, in part because the coming to your neighborhood soon is more likely to fan the flames of bigotry and discrimination that David was talking about than it is to lead people to write their senator to spend more money for research. I'm not unconcerned about the fact that AIDS is getting attention all out of proportion to its actual threat to the public health. There are, let's say, 17 or 18,000 diagnosed AIDS cases so far in this country. And there are somewhere between 6,500 and 7,000 people who have died of it, which is certainly significant. On the other hand, according to vital statistics, sort of government statistics, 45,000 people die in the United States every year from pneumonia. 50,000 women die of ovarian, uterine, and breast cancer. Lung cancer and emphysema kill more than 100,000 people a year. And 9,000 people die of alcohol-related cirrhosis of the liver. Now, there are many different kinds of life-threatening diseases that we all hear about and some that we don't hear much about. What's peculiar about AIDS is not that it's America's worst public health problem, which is what it was called in the media, or there's another phrase here from it, something about the health crisis of the century or something. It just isn't.
But cirrhosis of the liver isn't contagious, and neither is...
Neither is AIDS very much either. I mean, it is contagious, but it's not nearly as contagious as it is being represented. I'm old enough to remember the polio panics of the late 40s and the early 50s, and it has somewhat of the same quality of an over-excited or overextended hysteria. And my analysis, to the extent that I think one can make one, is in large part what I've already said, is that it feeds into an ongoing social, moral, and public agenda, namely the morality wars of the late 70s and early 80s.
I'd like to, at this point, open up the telephones and invite our listeners to call. And you might want to call. Joining us for this part of the program, by the way, will be David Weber, the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. And he spoke with us a little earlier. And also with me is Larry Gross, a professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications. He was just speaking. And he's co-chair of the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and a member of the AIDS Task Force. If you have any questions you'd like to ask either of them about the media or about civil liberties questions raised by the AIDS epidemic, our number is 923-2774. Or if you'd like to address the question of how you feel AIDS is affecting your life, you're welcome to do that too. And our phone number is 923-2774. Before we open up the phones, Larry, a couple of other questions for you. Now, as I mentioned, you also co-chair the Lesbian and Gay Task Force. Do you think that the AIDS epidemic has been increasing homophobia, and I know that the task force also recently issued a report on violence and harassment, violence against and harassment of lesbians and gays in Philadelphia.
But there's no question that it has. I think the main form that it's taken is that it has, well, two maybe. It has sort of been like one more push to people who are likely to commit acts of aggression or discrimination against gays. And I think even more important, it has sort of changed the public atmosphere in which these occur. The main problem that faces gay people in terms of violence and discrimination is not primarily the relatively few people who commit these acts, but the silent majority who do not stop them through their condemnation. And the problem with AIDS is it gives the bigots another stick to hit people with, and it scares the silent majority, so they're less likely to say something about it. It sort of becomes like this state representative we just heard. It gives people a chance to wrap themselves in some flag or banner of morality and to protect themselves from charges of bigotry. So it definitely has that effect.
How well do you think the Philadelphia gay community has organized around the issue of AIDS?
The Philadelphia community has done very well. I'd say the gay community in all over the country has organized very well. The advantage in Philadelphia is that people were prepared very quickly, that beginning in the fall of 81, there was organization long before there were any real cases in Philadelphia, so that by the time cases began to develop, there were mechanisms in place for dealing with them, and they've been very effective.
One last question, and then we'll open up the phones. Earlier on the show, we heard from Dennis Altman, who made a case for not seeing AIDS as a gay disease or a gay issue. To what extent do you think it's appropriate to treat AIDS in the media, or you know, for you in your view, to treat AIDS as a gay issue or a gay disease?
Well, I think in part, as I was saying earlier, you have to see it within the context of the way the culture is dealing with issues of sexuality and morality. I also would support the argument that Dennis has been making that as a medical and social service issue, it needs to be understood and interpreted in light of the extraordinarily backward and inadequate system of health insurance and health services that this country has and that most Americans don't even realize is as poor as it is.
Okay, we're going to open up the telephones now. Just speaking with Larry Gross, a professor of communications at the Annenberg School of the University of Pennsylvania. He co-chairs the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and is a member of the AIDS Task Force. Also with me, David Weber, legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I turned on the radio, I guess it was about 40 minutes ago, and I heard someone talking about proposing legislation that involved, you know, mandatory testing for people. And I heard you engaging with this person, and I was really shocked to find out when that I hadn't heard him introduced, and I was really shocked to find out that this person was a representative of government because he sounded so ignorant and really unintelligent. And I guess my question, besides that comment, would be, are there people who are in the legislature who are sort of more sensitive to this issue and who are advocating the appropriate kinds of positions to counter him? Because I really felt
Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, well, let me see if David Weber would like to respond to that.
Okay, I'm going to have to take my other call.
Oh, right, I get it.
I'll
okay.
be back in a second.
Go ahead.
Sure. Let me try to respond to that. There are many people, I think, in the legislature who have the right idea about how to handle the issues presented by AIDS. What's going to be in Pennsylvania a big issue is what kind of funding will be available to assist in public education efforts, and that will be coming up again later this spring. So that'll be very important to see how the legislature reacts there, and there are people who are very supportive of taking an approach which is consistent with civil liberties concerns and getting information out to people. Although I have to admit that a lot of the legislators are very negative on this because it's the nature of the legislature to be anti-gay or homophobic, however you want to describe it, and that's really where they're coming from. So that's what underlies a lot of the legislative initiatives that have been taken.
Okay, we'll take another phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, Terry. I understand the controversy between the civil rights of AIDS sufferers and the protection of society in general. My question is in concern with Representative Letterman's legislation. Is it such a bad thing to prevent people who have AIDS from having babies knowingly because in the future the cost of the taxpayer and fellow insurance policyholders could be large?
That's a good question, how we're going to deal with that situation. Certainly one of the most fundamental rights is right involved in child rearing. What I suspect is that looking at it more as a public policy issue than just as a legal issue, the way it will come out is individuals, once they understand what kind of problem there might be for their kids if they have the virus or if they actually have AIDS and have children, that once they understand that, they themselves are going to take some approach other than probably even having children. They may want to adopt children. That's a situation that presents itself in a number of different sort of medical contexts where there is some reason not to have children, and that's going to be up for those individuals to decide. But you know, there's no approach right now that's specifically geared to dealing with AIDS.
Okay, thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. And I'll ask you to keep your question or comment brief because we're really short on time.
Okay, first I'd like to comment on Altman's description about San Francisco mobilizing the city resources. And my question is, has the city of Philadelphia responded appropriately to the Gates AIDS crisis in health and welfare issues? Do they feel that? Is that their opinion?
Well, yeah, I think there's been a response. I suspect that there's a lot more that could be done, but I don't think either David or I are the best qualified people to answer that. I think there's more that could be done, and listeners could certainly help by communicating to their city council representatives that they feel that way.
One of Altman's points was that people were well mobilized around volunteer services, but when it came to issues like health insurance and research money and the more political issues behind AIDS, that there wasn't that much work being done.
Well, I think more could be done. I think research isn't a city issue. It's not even a state issue in terms of the funding. I think the concerns are, and here I'd be most worried about the state legislature, is precisely on things like insurance regulations and things like that. And the more people communicate to their representatives how they feel this is important, the better off we'll be.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling in regards to a question I'd like to address to Larry Gross.
Good, and I'll ask you to keep your question brief.
Yes. Most of the publications, newsprint media, especially like Newsweek and whatnot, they always demonstrate as far as that primarily white children have the disease. But when you look at the statistics nationally, they're black children. And the public seems to think that only white persons generally get the disease and not blacks.
Yes, so that's a problem that's very widespread, and it's very important, and I'm glad you asked the question because it needs to be understood here in Philadelphia. The media overall pay attention to white people much more than to anyone else. They pay attention to white men much more than to anyone else. They pay attention to middle-class white men more than anyone else. They can give you a very false image when that comes to problems that affect women or minorities or other groups. And the case of AIDS is a very good case. As far as I know, the statistics on the incidence of AIDS in the country very much parallel the proportion of ethnic and racial groups in the country, which means that in a city like Philadelphia, somewhat more than 40% of the AIDS cases have been among black men rather than among white. Yet the image presented in the media is overwhelmingly white. And from a public health standpoint and from an education standpoint, that is extremely dangerous because it would be false to lead people to a sense that this is a disease that just hits white people, when in fact it's a disease that hits everybody if they come into contact with it.
Okay, thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. And I'll ask you to keep your question or comment very brief. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've got two questions. The first one is addressed to David Weber. And you talked about the issue of insurance companies screening people for the blood test. I was wondering if they're using a second ELISA blood test or if they're using a Western blot to confirm their assay or if they were just doing one test and if you're positive, then throwing you out. And the second question was to Larry Gross, and you talked about the number of cases of AIDS patients of both deaths and diagnoses as that being very low. But you didn't address the fact that there's a trend of increasing exponential number of cases, which doesn't happen with the other diseases that you mentioned. And how do you feel about that? Will AIDS continue to increase exponentially? And what should we do with it if it does?
David, you want to take the first one?
Sure. The first question about the type of test that's used, it's an important question because the test, if it's going to be used at all, it's got to be reliable. We have to know that what it says is correct about the person's being exposed to the virus. The ELISA test you've referred to is a fairly accurate test, although it does give many, in a statistical basis, an unreasonable number of false positives. Though the insurance companies that are using any testing at all, I think that is not widespread, but certainly if they do it, they're going to have to do an initial test, a screening test, and then go through with a confirmatory test so that they're sure what the results are, even if they were going to do the testing at all.
Larry, you want to take the second question?
Well, the second question is one that I don't think anyone can answer at this point, which is what will the future rate of increase in diagnosed cases of AIDS be? It has been increasing, but the increase so far follows the trajectory of most epidemics in terms of exposed populations beginning to manifest symptoms. It's not clear at this point, and I think it'll take a while to find out if that will continue. But as I've read, at least, the discussions in the public health literature, it is very unlikely that that will continue in a kind of open-ended exponential increase because the much greater likelihood is that the majority of people within the risk communities who are going to be exposed have been exposed, and what we're doing is finding the symptoms, usually what's called the opportunistic diseases, appearing. I don't think that at this point the public health community is projecting an open-ended exponential increase.
Okay, well, that's all the phone calls we're going to have time for. I'd like to conclude our discussion by asking you briefly this. You both have very specialized fields from which you've been monitoring the AIDS epidemic, and I'd like to ask each of you to address what you think the biggest problem of perception is, misperception or misinformation from your field, and to just single out one thing that you'd like to, from your perspective, set straight. And David Wimmer, let me ask you to start first.
Well, I think the biggest problem we have in any legal any legal problem that comes up is being able to identify the basic information you need to analyze then the legal issues. So the starting point is that this is an illness which is very difficult to transmit to someone else. It's only under very special unusual special circumstances where that happens. And once you start from that point, questions about quarantine, about problems with coworkers or what have you, those problems, those pseudo problems, begin to disappear. And that way we can take an approach which is a very sound approach to the issues, both in regard to the public health issues and the civil liberties concerns.
Larry Gross?
Well, I think the kind of thing I'm concerned about is that the public understanding of AIDS, of gay people, and of sexuality have a tendency or a danger of running together, so that the situation increases the identification of gays with sex and at the same time increases the identification of sex with disease, and it sort of simultaneously does us two disservices. It does a major disservice to the way in which we as a society understand and deal with a sizable minority. It makes lesbians even more invisible than they are otherwise. It makes gays seen as sexual rather than human beings. And I suspect of even larger concern for the future of the society, it plays into an identification of sex as dangerous, sex as deadly, sex as fatal, that I think is part of a sort of moral reaction that has many, many implications beyond the question of AIDS.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. With me has been Larry Gross, a professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications, and he's co-chair of the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and a member of the AIDS Task Force. Also with me, David Weber, legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force and legal counsel for Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force. Well, that concludes our two-day series on AIDS, Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. Yesterday we discussed the current medical knowledge about AIDS, and today we covered some of the legal, social, and political repercussions of the epidemic. Remember that experts agree that AIDS can't be transmitted through casual contact. On yesterday's show, a panel of experts agreed that AIDS is not spread through saliva or kissing. It can be transmitted through blood-to-blood contact, such as sharing IV drug needles, and it can be spread when infected sperm enters the bloodstream through anal intercourse. It can also be spread through sperm during vaginal intercourse, but that is less likely to happen. One of the recommended safe sex practices is the use of a condom. the best way we have now of stopping the further spread of the epidemic is education. And the clearinghouse for information about AIDS in Philadelphia is the AIDS Task Force, and their hotline number is 732-AIDS. That's 732-AIDS. And you can also use that number if you want to volunteer to work with the task force. Again, the number 732-AIDS, A-I-D-S. This special series on AIDS was co-produced by Amy Salad. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, all things considered, coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening next week on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. Skookula Expressway westbound, nightmare conditions, up to 30-minute delays west of Montgomery Drive all the way out to Belmont. Eastbound, 20 minutes in traffic from Gladwin to the Twin Bridges. North on 95, very heavy now between Allegheny and a point north of the Betsy Ross Bridge. The problem is southbound, just south of the Bridge Street exit, a three-vehicle accident blocking the left-hand lane. Also some slow going there. Over in New Jersey, a few accidents, a few problems. One of them is south on Route 42. Very, very slow between Tudor and Route 55. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded by Subaru. This Sunday at 6 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, who will talk about his imprisonment in South Africa for helping to lead the movement to get South Africa banned from the Olympics. Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, my guest will be folk singer Patrick Sky. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by composer Michael Saul. Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by the two co-authors of a new book about the history of the TV program Saturday Night Live. Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, my guest will be novelist Kurt Vonnegut. And Thursday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, my guest will be star of stage and screen Sir Alec Guinness. Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by novelist Margaret Atwood. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air or any feedback you'd like to mail our way, please write to us. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Audrey Voblaitis was the engineer for today's show. Production assistance from Millie Moffitt. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller, the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a terrific weekend. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Cokie Roberts.
And I'm David Malpas with All Things Considered.
We in the Senate are the only ones that are really making it open and credible. And I don't like the way that the Rogers Commission is doing it.
From what I have seen in the first 15 days, they have made very great progress. What we would do is get in their way.
Senators Danforth and Hollings debate whether the Presidential Commission investigating the Challenger explosion is doing a good job. Tonight on All Things Considered, should the Senate conduct its own shuttle inquiry?
Also these stories, former CIA agent Larry Wutai Chen, convicted of spying, commits suicide.
Philippine opposition leader Aquino meets with President Reagan's envoy in Manila.
And the oldest man in the world reported dead.
First, this news update.
This is Mark Borgman. As many as 50 people were hurt, four critically, when chlorine gas escaped from a manufacturing plant outside Los Angeles today. Officials say the chlorine cloud leaked from a ruptured pipe at the Purex Company facility, forcing the evacuation of the plant and a nearby elementary school. Several students were among the injured. Former CIA analyst and convicted spy Larry Wutai Chin today committed suicide in his jail cell outside Washington, D.C. Officials say Chin suffocated himself by placing a plastic bag over his head. The suicide came just 2 weeks after he was found guilty of selling secrets to China. A State Department spokesman says a colonel in the Soviet KGB has defected to the United States along with his 7-year-old son and a family friend. State Department spokesman Charles Redman identifies the man as Viktor P. Gundarov, a KGB colonel posted in Athens. Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos is sending a high-level delegation to Washington for talks with Reagan administration officials. The State Department says the delegation may arrive this weekend. Today, Marcos lashed out at those who have challenged his re-election, saying sore losers and modern-day imperialists in foreign capitals are trying to taint his election victory. Police in Glendale, California today announced two arrests in the Wednesday killing of Oscar Salvatierra, the Los Angeles bureau chief for a U.S.-based anti-Marcos Philippine newspaper. Steve Futterman reports.
After initial speculation that politics might be involved, Glendale police today said a domestic dispute was the motive for the killing of Oscar Salvatierra, and authorities announced the arrest of the newspaper executive's 17-year-old son and the son's 18-year-old girlfriend. Police accused the pair of trying to use the current political situation in the Philippines as a cover for their crime. The two, according to the police, were the ones behind a death threat received by Salvatierra only the day before his murder, a threat which appeared to make the killing a possible political reprisal. Glendale Police Chief David Thompson said the father and son did not get along. He used the word hatred to describe the relationship. Meanwhile, both suspects are in custody. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Just when Northern Californians thought the worst of the flooding was over, the Yuba River overflowed its banks last night, forcing the evacuation of more than 20,000 people. William Drummond reports.
Before the Yuba River overflowed last night, state officials released figures on the flood damage caused by flooding earlier in the week. The storm damage comes to more than $300 million statewide. That total is bound to go up now that a huge chunk of the levee on the Yuba River north of Sacramento gave way yesterday, spilling 4,000 cubic feet of water per second across a 24-square-mile area. Construction crews today are working to close the break, and National Guard boats and helicopters are patrolling the flooded areas of the small town of Linda. They're looking for anybody who might have been left behind in last night's evacuation. Some people have been plucked off rooftops where they spent the night. 10 Red Cross shelters have been set up in nearby Yuba City, Sutter, Wheatland, and Beale Air Force Base. In San Francisco, I'm William Drummond.
Israeli troops stormed through Muslim villages in southern Lebanon today in a continued search for two Israeli soldiers who were captured by Muslim guerrillas 5 days ago. Israeli troops rounded up hundreds of villagers and fired shots over the heads of UN peacekeeping forces who were trying to deliver food and water. One of the UN soldiers was wounded. It was the first day of school for a teenaged AIDS victim in Kokomo, Indiana today, but many of his schoolmates stayed home to protest. We have a report from Greg Zawisha of member station WBAA.
14-year-old Ryan White said it was good to be back at school today after a 14-month absence, telling reporters after school that he just wants to get back to a normal life. Ryan is a hemophiliac who got AIDS from tainted blood products. He'd been banned from the Western Middle School near Kokomo, Indiana this school year because of fears that AIDS might spread. After a lengthy court and administrative fight, a county health officer last week pronounced him fit to go back to school and said Ryan posed no threat to other students or teachers. However, worried parents threatened earlier in the week to keep their students from class if Ryan was allowed to attend. And this afternoon, a judge was holding a hearing on a restraining order request brought by some parents in the school system to keep Ryan out. About 43% of the students at the school were absent today, but Principal Ron Colby said snowy weather and flu cases could have been a partial factor. For National Public Radio, this is Greg Zawisha in West Lafayette, Indiana.
The Eastern Airlines Board of Directors held an emergency meeting today after pilots voted to authorize a strike against the company at 12:01 Wednesday, unless a contract agreement is reached by then. Eastern has warned that it will shut down and lay off thousands of its 42,000 employees if there is a strike. Yet another record on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial Average gained more than 24 points, closing the week at 1697.71. Trading was described as heavy. I'm Mark Boardman, NPR in Washington.
More news tonight on Americans involved in spying. Our first report, Larry Wutai Chen, facing life imprisonment as a spy, committed suicide today in his jail cell. Chen was 63, a native of China, and a naturalized U.S. citizen. He admitted selling secrets to China for more than 30 years during and after his career as a CIA analyst. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
A Justice Department spokesman said Chen apparently put a plastic bag over his head and suffocated. He was convicted of spying exactly 2 weeks ago today. Chen was awaiting sentencing, which was scheduled for March 17th. He was found in his cell by jail officials at 8:45 this morning. Paramedics from the fire department located next door to the jail arrived in minutes and attempted to revive him. but it was too late. Chin was pronounced dead at 9:35 this morning. Chin's last public appearance was this week on the CBS News program Night Watch. Field producer Kathy Paterno said that Chin seemed calm during the interview and said he fully expected to spend the rest of his life in prison.
But he said it's a small price to pay for following my conscience. So he was resigned to that fact, and then on top of that, he was almost optimistic that maybe something would happen. Someone might step in and either commute a sentence or possibly send him back to China. He said, if I have my druthers and have to stay the rest of my life in jail or go back to China, of course I'd go back there but work for the good of the two countries.
When he took the stand in his own defense, Chin admitted that he had passed classified information to the Chinese. He said it was part of a personal mission to bring about improved Chinese-American relations. Chin received more than $180,000 for spying, but he called the money only a byproduct of his mission. As an interpreter for the CIA, Chin had access to the highest levels of classified information. During his four-day trial in federal court earlier this month, the prosecution charged that Chin began giving secret information to the Chinese communists as early as 1952. When FBI agents first questioned Chin last November, he spent 6 hours talking to them, even though the agents told him he could ask them to leave. Chin also kept diaries with meticulous details of his spy trips and financial transactions, including his foreign bank accounts. Chin, who was a tall, lean man, sat quietly throughout the trial. The jury deliberated for 3.5 hours before finding him guilty on all 17 counts of spying, as well as income tax and financial reporting violations. Chin showed no emotion when the verdict was announced. The U.S. Marshals Service is conducting an investigation to determine the circumstances of Chin's death. Today, officials would say little. An autopsy will be performed tomorrow. Results of the investigation are expected early next week. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
In London today, another U.S. citizen was charged with spying, John Bothwell, a retired U.S. Navy.